Friday night was fight night in the White House. This time last week, events in the past 7 days have cast a full-blown fallout in a different light. I'm Gavin Lee. Welcome to The World This Week. And it's been a week where the US has turned the screws on Ukraine and its ability to defend itself against Russian occupation. Military aid and intelligence support to Kyiv put on pause unless and until, according to President Trump's team, Ukraine's ungrateful leader shows more willingness to seek peace, starting with signing over the rights to half of Ukraine's rare earth resources to the US as payback for America's support so far. And at the same time, Moscow announced the new US foreign policy, quote, largely aligns with the Kremlin's vision. Kyiv, meanwhile, sensing the speed of deteriorating relations, resorted to writing a Dear Donald letter, giving something the president could present in the room in his first speech to Congress.
The letter reads, Ukraine is ready to come to the negotiating table as soon as possible to bring lasting peace closer. Nobody wants peace more than the Ukrainians, he said. My team and I stand ready to work under President Trump's strong leadership to get a peace that lasts.
It's been a week that's seen the most significant act of protectionism announced in America since 1930. On Tuesday, Donald Trump saw through on his campaign promise of tariffs imposing a 25% duty on imports from Canada and Mexico and bumping up the duty on China from 10% he'd already put on to 20%. The move would make America richer again, he said, at the expense, it seems, of friend and foe. And at great risk too. It led to sharp drops in the US and global markets. The Wall Street Journal called it the dumbest tariff war in history. There were some signs of rollback by the end of the week. And Canada's outgoing leader Justin Trudeau responded with his own Dear Donald.
Now, it's not in my habit to agree with the Wall Street Journal. But Donald, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do.
It's seen a week that's been a breakthrough moment in Turkey. A possible end in sight for one of the world's oldest conflicts, a guerrilla insurgency that lasted four decades and led to more than 40,000 deaths. The Kurdish outlawed group, the PKK, declared a ceasefire at the weekend, days after its leader and founder, Abdullah Öcalan, wrote a letter from his prison cell calling for the group to convene, disarm, disband. The armed struggle, he said, had run its course, a step towards peaceful coexistence. A good news story of the week. We look at the reasons for the good vibes, the complications, and how it could extend President Erdogan's time in office.
There is an opportunity to take a historic step towards tearing down the wall of terror that has stood between Turkish and Kurdish people's thousand-year-old brotherhood.
And dear Denmark, it's been a week that the Danish government declared letters a thing of the past. Its postal service, Nordpost, is going to end all letter deliveries, citing a 90% decline since the beginning of the century, from 1.4 billion back then to 110 million last year. A bold step in a new age or a sad loss of a cultural craft? Answers on a postcard, please.
The red mailboxes, as we know them, will not be found in the cityscape after the 1st of January.
In the studio alongside me tonight on the programme, a great friend of the programme, Vivian Walt, Paris correspondent for Time magazine, seasoned international journalist. Vivian, whilst it's very good to see you, I probably imagine you are a letter writer or have been in the past. Do you send anything handwritten nowadays or does anything you've received recently handwritten?
I really miss them. I have boxes of old letters and I have boxes of my parents' letters. I think it's a great loss, actually. Funny enough, I just got back from Denmark and it is one of those countries where you feel like you're looking at the future. And I suspect it's the first of many countries to do this.
Well, Germany has just announced yesterday 800,000 job losses in the postal service as well, the Deutsche Post. So it is a familiar feeling in Europe. Victor Mallet is also here, senior editor at the FT, the Financial Times, long-time continent-crossing journalist, author of River of Life, River of Death, The Ganges and India's Future, and The Trouble with Tigers, The Rise and Fall of Southeast Asia. Victor, brilliant to have you with us.
Thank you.
Are you a letters man? And if so, same question, when was the last time you sent one?
I did actually quite recently. I mean, I think condolence letters and thank you letters and postcards, you know, cards, greetings cards. I think it is quite nice to get them by post. And I'm actually quite, you know, surprised in a way that even a modern country like Denmark would do this, because it does actually sort of take away that other option that one has to communicate. And of course, yeah, as Vivian was saying, in the old days, one really did communicate by letter. And of course, they were long and they were interesting and they were, you know, full of useful information that you don't bother to put in an email. So I think it is a loss. Yeah.
And it takes it to a romantic age, I think, as well, doesn't it? Yeah, correspondence. Yeah. And also, probably relevant as well, to go to the Ukraine capital and bring in Toma Istomina at this point. Toma, great to have you with us because, well, you're the deputy chief editor of the Kyiv Independent. On the issue of the death of the letter, wartime correspondents, as I mentioned, often become wartime artefacts of vivid accounts of life in conflict. We think of poets, we think of social history of their letters home. Do you still get any letters at the Kyiv Independent, or does it prove the point that the contact is all online now?
It's all online. For now, it's actually quite hard to send anything to Ukraine or out of Ukraine. I mean, it's still possible, but it takes more time. And for security reasons, we actually don't share our legal address in Kyiv. So our readers don't really have that option. But online, we've been getting tons and tons of emails over the past couple of weeks with a lot of support. A lot of them coming from America specifically, showing that a lot of the American people do not agree with the new policy that Trump's administration is now rolling out. And we've been very, very grateful to have that connection with the audience and hearing from them at this difficult moment.
Which we will get onto in a moment. The very significant 7 days, another heavy day of bombardment today. Energy installations targeted as well. Let's go to Florida. Let's bring in Rick Wilson, Republican political strategist, a field director in the past for the 1988 Bush campaign, author as well. Good to have you with us, Rick. You also founded the Lincoln Project, and I read that its focus was once against President Trump's election, but you're now more opposing so-called MAGA extremism. What is MAGA extremism?
Well, Donald Trump and his party now represent something well past what the Republican Party that I worked in for 40 years represents. They are authoritarian. They are autocratic. They have become, as you can see this in the last 7 days, an overtly pro-Putin, pro-authoritarian party that doesn't represent any of the conservative values that shaped my upbringing in the former Republican Party.
We were talking letters as well. When we come to, if you were advising Volodymyr Zelensky this week in his Dear Donald letter, did he get the tone right? It seemed to have an apology full of remorse. What did you make of that?
Look, Donald Trump is an inexplicable creature. People understand how to push the buttons inside of Donald Trump that make Donald Trump less dangerous to them. And while I believe that that letter was appropriately toned, the problem for Zelensky is that Trump views Putin as a role model. Trump views Putin as someone to emulate. Trump views Vladimir Putin as the future of America's relationships in the world. And so I think that Zelensky will get the rug pulled out of him until and unless Europe appears to be stepping up to the degree to which it can substitute for some of the support and the weapon systems that America had provided to Ukraine. And if Trump sees that the tide is running against Putin, he will flip sides once again and believe that Vladimir Zelensky is his best friend in the whole wide world.
Which takes us into the big issues of this week. And let's start with a potted history of the past 7 days. It was late on Monday when news first came through from the US of a seismic policy change on Ukraine after 3 years of American support for Kyiv in its defense against Russia, and the terms such as unflagging commitment and standing side by side for, quote, as long as it takes. The message from the new White House administration on Monday night: military aid to Ukraine will be paused immediately. So too it transpired the following day. Intelligence support, no more intel from the most powerful intelligence machine in the world. Listening to the senior Trump officials this week, the message seemed clear: not to count on their support, to go back when ready to show gratitude and remorse for upsetting Donald Trump last week. And when they are more serious about agreeing peace terms with Russia, well, there was barely time for the Ukrainian diplomats to blink, and it seemed for Volodymyr Zelensky he could do no right in the eyes of the US presidents. So he resorted to sending this letter, said to have contained the apology for the White House row, an appreciation of Trump's team, strength and commitment to peace. It appears, at least publicly, to have appeased the American president for now. According to Steve Witkoff, Trump's longtime friend, Middle East special envoy and increasingly a key dealmaker on Ukraine.
Well, I think those are all decisions of the president, but I think he felt that Zelensky's letter was a very positive first step. There was an apology. There was an acknowledgement that the United States has done so much for the country of Ukraine, and a sense of gratitude. I think that's the biggest deal, right? Like, we've supported that country, and I think it's important when you support somebody that that person comes back and acknowledges that and says, you know, how do you want, how is it that we should be? It's not just some sort of unilateral way of processing these things.
Which takes us to events this evening, to which Donald Trump has said, quote, he found it easier to deal with Russia than with Ukraine, that they don't have the cards, that he trusts and believes Vladimir Putin. At the same time, on social media, he put out that he would threaten sanctions, possible tariffs on Russia, because of what he called the pounding of Ukraine. Let's take a listen to Donald Trump this evening.
We're doing very well with Russia. But right now, they're bombing the hell out of Ukraine. And Ukraine, I'm finding it more difficult, frankly, to deal with Ukraine. And they don't have the cards. They don't have the cards. As you know, we're meeting in Saudi Arabia on sometime next week, early. And we're talking. I find that in terms of getting a final settlement, it may be easier dealing with Russia, which is surprising because they have all the cards. I mean, they're bombing the hell out of them right now. And I put a statement in, a very strong statement. Can't do that. Can't do that.
Mr. President?
We're trying to help them. And Ukraine has to get on the ball and get a job done.
Okay, apology, gratitude received. This is days on. What do you make of the position, Vivian, that Ukraine is in right now?
You know, I think what's so disturbing is you have, on the one hand, this hot war that's been going on for 3 years, that's killed hundreds of thousands of people. And you have the president of the most powerful country in the world behaving effectively like a schoolyard bully. Prickly, thin-skinned, God forbid somebody should not like bow down to him or thank him. I mean, it's kind of infantile. And I think the disjuncture has basically thrown everybody completely off kilter, let alone the fact that you have Zelensky going to Washington. There's no flights in and out of Kyiv. It's a long journey for him, a seven-hour time difference. He's exhausted after 3 years of war, let alone his speaking his third language in the Oval Office. The entire thing I found excruciating, from including the letter.
7 days of excruciation. Victor, interesting, I heard John Sawyers, former head of MI6, saying that the fallout of last week's events, the kind of making Zelensky pay, he thought it was set up. He said there's no other way to allow a vice president to come in like that. Yeah. What's your take?
I completely agree. It seemed to me a setup. And it went wrong for Trump and Vance, so they got angry. Remember, it wasn't Zelensky who raised his voice. It was Vance and Trump who raised their voices. And all Zelensky was doing was gently correcting the facts, you know, about how the war had started and so on, and what needed to be done. And that's exactly what Macron had done. It's exactly what Keir Starmer had done in the White House, or with Trump. And when Zelensky did it, you know, they blew their top, I think, because it was clearly a setup. But the weird thing is that, you know, Trump says he's offering a deal to Ukraine, but he's not offering anything to Ukraine. There's nothing in the deal except what America did under the Biden administration, and that's in the past. If you're making a deal, you've got to offer somebody something in exchange. And what, obviously, the U.S. should be offering is pressure on Russia to stop the war, and he's not offering that. So you have this kind of very weird situation where he's talking about a deal, but it's not a deal because you don't offer anything. And you know, the one-sided nature of it is absolutely extraordinary. You know, and people are saying that if Trump was a Russian agent or a Russian asset, what would he have done that he hasn't already done? And the answer, sadly, is very little. You know, there's almost nothing that he hasn't already done. The only weird thing about it is that if he was a Russian asset or a Russian agent, he's been incredibly obvious about it in a way that a real spy would not be. And that's really the only sort of explanation one can make about this whole thing. It's so utterly, and it was excruciating to watch these kind of bullying characters, you know, having a go and basically lying about the situation and then chucking him out of the White House. It was just absolutely bizarre.
And yet the White House position, the senior figures within the White House, including J.D. Vance, continue their view, which is the security guarantee is in the essence of US economic interest being in Ukraine, that they can maintain themselves there, so therefore Russia wouldn't attack because there are US employees there.
Yeah, but that's what they said about Afghanistan, I think, as well. And look what happened with that. No, I mean, I think that's utterly implausible. I mean, clearly the only way, as Vib was saying, this is a massive war. You know, this is not a sort of, this is a massive hot war. This is not a situation where you're going to have American mining prospectors wandering around eastern Ukraine and looking for you know, rare metals. This is absolutely nonsense. You know.
Nonsense, says Viktor. Toma, how is this being seen in Kyiv? And tell me about the conversations your team is having with officials there and the position that they're in right now.
Well, I think it's been absolutely disappointing, and it's been a very difficult couple of weeks for Ukraine to realize finally that we lost our key ally, and nobody really means his words in Ukraine about what happened in the Oval Office and what's been happening this week with the halt of aid, with the halt of intelligence sharing, which primarily will affect civilians. Everyone is saying that, you know, compared to last year when USAID was on hold while there was this political infighting in Congress and they couldn't pass an aid package for like half a year. Compared to that time, Ukraine is much better prepared on the battlefield. But in the rear, intercepting Russian missiles will be potentially much more difficult. The intelligence sharing element, that will largely affect Ukraine's capability to detect threats from the air in advance and alert its civilian population about it. So it's absolutely outrageous what is happening, and I don't think we should be talking about the appeasement, the letters, the suits, all these details. You know, as the whole controversy about Zelensky's suit, and a fashion historian, a Ukrainian fashion historian, pointed out a very good thing, that when somebody makes comments about someone's clothing, it's never about the clothing. It's always about the prejudice that they already have about that person. And that's exactly what happened in the White House, and that's what continues to be happening. Obviously, Donald Trump sided with Russia. That's what happened. Donald Trump just said at the briefing right before we have this show, he said that Vladimir Putin is pounding Ukraine. He's hitting Ukraine harder than ever. And it makes sense that he's doing it because that's what anybody would do in this situation. He makes no sense. He's taking away Ukraine's ability to defend itself on its own territory. And that's his definition of peace. And that's how he sees a peace deal that will win him a Nobel Prize, apparently. The easiest way to end this war, it's so obvious, it's to pressure Russia, because Russia is the one who came to the Ukrainian land and who is killing civilians on this land. So what you need to do is obviously hamper Russia's ability to wage this war. Donald Trump, I think that man doesn't make much sense, but I think he's smart enough to understand that that's how you end the war. And he's clearly not taking any steps to do that. So I think there can only be one conclusion out of it, is that he's siding with Russia. He wants this war to be over on his terms, on the US terms. Ukraine is pushing back against that, and that's exactly what is irritating him. And that's the whole problem. After that, apparently the plan is to just move on to business as usual, be friends with Putin, who murdered thousands of people in Ukraine and not only in Ukraine. And that's the new world that we're in. And I think it's time to start talking about it in the clear terms. And I'm happy that this Oval Office clash happened, because if it didn't happen, if it wasn't so, like, you know, it all came out in the open and we finally know what this administration actually thinks, what their values are, their usage of disinformation and Russian talking points, yeah. their irritation with Ukraine and Zelensky, yeah. all of that came onto the surface, and we know it as it is. And that came as a big, big red flag for both Ukraine and Europe as a huge reality check. And now nobody can just pretend and hope that, you know, Trump, this most influential person in the world, will come and make peace and he has good intentions. Mm. No, we know what it is now. And I'm very happy that that clash happened. And everyone opened their eyes finally on this administration.
Hasten perhaps what might have been inevitable later on down the line. Very interesting, Rick, listening to Thomas. On the point about going on to other business, it was very interesting to listen to Donald Trump in Congress this week. The nominated Democrat to address him was Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, and said he stole the line, he steals it constantly, peace through strength, from Ronald Reagan. And she went on to say, as a Cold War kid, she's thankful Reagan and not Trump was in the White House. Said Trump would have lost us the Cold War. And I think this gets to the heart of the allegations against him right now, doesn't it? Appeasement in the face of a dictator who's trampled all over appeasing voices in the past.
Vladimir Putin's record over the last 25 years that he's been in power, he has violated 190 treaties and memorandums of understanding with other countries, and he is a bad actor. He is not a guy you can trust his word on at all. There's one person in the world who believes Vladimir Putin can be believed categorically, and that's Donald Trump. And Americans disagree with Trump on this by really significant margins. Americans do not think Vladimir Putin is the good guy. They do believe Vladimir Putin is a dictator. They know that Vladimir Putin has attacked Ukraine. They know that Vladimir Putin attacks Ukrainian civilians. They disagree with Trump on this point. And Donald Trump, a man who normally has a very acute nose for public sentiment, is running against the tide very heavily in this country right now. And he's running against the tide in the world in a way where you're seeing Europe come together in a way that is almost unprecedented in terms of a security architecture. And they're creating a post-American Europe, a post-American version of NATO. They're creating a different security apparatus because America has become an unreliable ally because of one man. Mm. And the dangers are evident to everyone. And I think Trump has a fairly short runway on this. His repeated line of they don't have any cards. Russia and Trump don't have the cards right now if Europe stands up to force a peace deal that would end up with a partition of Ukraine and a reward for Vladimir Putin's illegal war that has largely targeted civilians in the course of the last 3 years.
One very important point, we're going to get onto the issues of Europe in just a moment, actually, because there are many to start to look at, including this so-called coalition of the willing that kind of fits outside the box of the EU and NATO, includes, you know, Turkey, Canada, the UK and others as well. But just back to your moment, Thomas, one thing that struck me is when we've heard in recent months, or in recent 6 weeks now, since he came into office, of John Bolton and others being stripped of their security clearances, it did strike me about a wider concern of the safety of Volodymyr Zelensky. Is that, you know, through all of this, a man Russia has tried to assassinate, is that something that, you know, he's publicly ridiculed, he's lied about by an ally? Is that something that's being discussed, a concern, something you've reported on?
I think the focus right now is more on the American push for elections and replacing Volodymyr Zelensky. There's clear hatred from that administration that probably goes back to 2019, I think it was, when Donald Trump was seeking some sort of cooperation with Zelensky, was trying to, you know, have that famous quid pro quo with Zelensky and didn't get that cooperation that he wanted from him. It's still probably influencing the perception of Zelensky by this administration. And that's what's been widely discussed primarily. I think it's absolutely outrageous that the American government is now just openly saying that they want to interfere with this election, pretty much. We have reports that they have talks with opposition politicians. They're actively looking for a candidate that can represent their interests, apparently, that can replace Zelensky. They are demanding from him to step down. It's absolutely outrageous. But more importantly, I think It's not only a tragedy, but it shows also that this administration, Trump's team, doesn't have a good understanding of current Ukraine. Just like Putin in 2022, this administration thinks that Ukraine has no agency, that Ukraine is just a small spot on the map where you can come and dictate what needs to happen in this country. But there's been a huge pushback to this treatment of our leader in Ukraine. Zelensky's rating has grown by 10% in the past week. It's now at around 68%, according to the latest poll published today. All Ukrainian people are just rallying behind Zelensky because obviously they see this as an unfair treatment, and there is no demand, there's no interest in Ukraine. People don't support the idea of elections during war. They do understand all the danger that will come with it, and they understand how difficult it will be to actually hold a fair election, because these people, unlike Trump's administration, none of whom have been to Ukraine except for Kellogg, whose voice apparently doesn't really matter anymore inside that team. And of course, Ukrainian people understand what an election would actually look like in current. So that's a more of a concern at the moment, I think. And it's very, very alarming that people like Elon Musk and members of Trump's team allow themselves to openly say that they want a leader of a democratic country, an elected leader of a democratic country, just replaced. But they are facing a disappointment ahead of themselves, because Ukraine will not accept this, and Ukraine is known for pushing back in the most impossible of circumstances.
To which they seem to be showing resolve now, don't they, on the battlefield in the east. I know they're losing ground, I think, in Kursk at the moment with the counteroffensive and the pushback from Russia and some of the North Korean forces there as well. But it does take you to the immediacy of a lack of intelligence. You mentioned Elon Musk. Starlink is still a big question. We think that's in place, that vital satellite communication network across most of Ukraine. And it takes us as well to the points that was made a moment ago, the rearmament of Europe by Rick. We saw these two quickly scrambled summits of European leaders this week. Sunday, Lancaster House in London. 18 countries were included, mostly European, Turkey, Canada alongside. The host, Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer, set out the stakes. It's a once-in-a-generation moment for security, he said, and proposed a so-called coalition of the willing, a French British-led peacekeeping force in event of a truce. He encouraged other nations to join. The Economist called him Winston Starmer. In attempting, they said, to mediate a toxic relationship between Vladimir Zelensky and Mr. Trump, it says the stiff upper lip, which has been a liability at home, is suddenly an asset if the grand plan doesn't fall apart. Then, 8 o'clock on the dot on Wednesday evening in Paris, President Macron addresses the nation, 13-minute speech on what Europe can do next. The future of the continent, he said, cannot be decided by Moscow or Washington. It's a new era, he warned, with peace and security more uncertain and a war that was not diminishing.
Russia has become and will remain a threat to France and Europe, which I deeply regret. However, in the long term, peace will return to our continent with a pacified Russia. For now, we must focus on the situation before us. To remain mere spectators in this dangerous world would be reckless. Without further ado, we must take steps to guarantee the security of France, Europe, and above all, Ukraine.
Pour l'Ukraine d'abord. L'Europe de la défense.
Therefore, the European defence sector, which we've been advocating for over the past 8 years, must become a reality. This will enable European countries to defend and protect themselves, produce the equipment they need domestically, cooperate more effectively, and reduce their dependence on external actors.
On Thursday night, another European summit on Thursday night convened, a last-minute one with European and EU leaders. Stark language similar with the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, say Russia is a clear and present danger. Talk, too, of sharing France's nuclear capabilities at a European level. Victor, let's start with your thoughts on the level of danger as seen by leaders right now. What do you make of the messaging we've just seen this week?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Europe has been united by this. But I think, you know, we're all, Europe in particular, is struggling to come to terms with the reality of what's happened. It would be bad enough if the United States had just stood aside and was no longer sort of a party to the conflict, as it were. But it's worse than that. The US actually seems to be actively supporting Russia and actively attacking its enemies, its former friends, you know, like Canada, the European Union, and members of the European Union, and Mexico. It's just bizarre the way that all the kind of firepower of the Trump administration in foreign policy has been directed at America's former allies, and very, very little of it at Russia. In fact, almost nothing at Russia until today, when he mentioned the possibility of some kind of enhanced sanctions. But essentially, this is not a matter of America no longer, you know, wanting to take part in the conflict and wanting to stand aside. The reality is that America has taken the other side, is siding with Russia. And whatever happens, it's going to take years before Europe can replace, the defense might of the United States, both in terms of, you know, America's military might, but also in terms of defense industry. I mean, European nations are, in most cases, very, very dependent on U.S. weapons and U.S. The U.S. alliance or the NATO alliance for their military operations. I mean, Britain in particular, even Britain's nuclear deterrent is not wholly independent, because it's dependent on U.S. technical support, because the missiles are from the U.S. So you have a sort of massively fundamental problem for Europe is that even if it does get together with the best will in the world and provides the money available and begins to form its own kind of defense alliance, which is kind of leaving America out, it's going to take years and years to do that effectively. So this is a very, very difficult moment, I think, for everybody. Politically, yes, they're united, but they all know the reality is they still depend on the United States, and they need to somehow manage that process until they get genuine independence.
And it's who comes forward at this moment as well. And Vivian, I want to go to you, Rick, and get the same question here, because there's kind of a jockeying for position as who is the bridge to the US, and whether that is even the right term, given that what Victor said right now about how you diplomatically deal with Donald Trump. Keir Starmer said this week, who sees himself as the bridge, but transatlantically, he said he's not an unreliable partner, which is kind of in contrast to what we heard from the likes of Friedrich Merz in Germany. Winston Stormer, the economist, said, and yet we've also seen this kind of, frankly, many would see as obsequiousness, the way he was with President Trump in the Kings of State visit letter last week. Who do you see as the key voices emerging?
I mean, there is no one better at the moment, and Britain has always played that role, which is why Brexit was so damaging for the EU. I mean, let alone Britain, obviously. But for the EU, it was a true loss, because it was the bridge to the US. More tellingly, if you listen to what Macron said, really, he said exactly the same thing nearly 8 years ago when he first came to power. He made this huge speech at the Sorbonne here in Paris. It became one for the ages, that speech, in which he warned Europe that they had to get their act together in defense. And everybody in EU style, you know, had big talking shops about this, and basically nothing happened.
And the Germans were annoyed, right?
And here we are, 8 years later. Yeah. 8 years later, having to start from scratch under way worse conditions. It seems to me, and I'd love to hear what Rick has to say about this, that really, for Trump, the thing he can't stand the least is the European Union. And through all of this, I have always felt that really is his real target, is breaking up the EU. And, you know, we see great unity here in Paris and Brussels and all these, you know, week full of summitry. And I really hope it lasts. I have my doubts, and I hope it lasts. But it seems to me that they're up against a real problem in Washington.
Rick, to Vivian's point, is there a special place of darkness in President Trump's heart or pocket that he holds for the EU? How do you see it?
In Trump, but in some of the advisors around him, they do envision a post a world in which there's a sort of tripartite partition of the world where Russia controls Europe, China controls Asia, the U.S. controls North and South America. That's why Trump's emphasizing and his advisors are pushing take over Greenland, take over Panama, invade Canada. As ludicrous as those things sound, they have a sort of internally consistent hatred of institutions that would oppose that. And they do see the EU, and frankly, a lot of them saw NATO until last week, in which they believe they've killed NATO effectively, as the a counterweight to that goal of whacking up the world into three chunks for three, you know, essential mob families is more of the approach than allies, diplomacy, and alliances.
And there's a kind of double argument going on right now, especially here in France. You have Emmanuel Macron, the idea of this, the concept of peacekeepers, which I want to touch on as well, British and French-led, reports that it's up to 30,000. So on the one hand, you've got J.D. Vance, vice president, you know, this insulting the commitments, as seen by the eyes of many in Europe, of the deaths of British and French soldiers on the battlefield. Let's have a listen to what J.D. Vance was saying to Fox News this week.
Yeah, Sean, here's the problem with the Europeans. And a lot of these guys are our friends, they're our allies. We, of course, you know, the president has a great relationship with a lot of European heads of state, and so do I, but they need to be realistic. Mm-hmm. And the craziest part about this, Sean, is that sometimes you'll have European heads of state who in public will puff up their chest and say, we're in it with President Zelensky for the next 10 years. And then in private, they'll pick up the phone and say, this can't go on forever. If you want real security guarantees, if you want to actually ensure that Vladimir Putin does not invade Ukraine again, the very best security guarantee is to give Americans economic upside in the future of Ukraine. That is a way better security guarantee than 20,000 troops from some random country that hasn't fought a war in 30 or 40 years.
Victor, so President Macron is dealing with that, so too Keir Starmer. He's rolled back some of those comments, saying he wasn't referring to Britain or France. He said that's absurdly dishonest to suggest it was either of those two. But President Macron is also dealing with Napoleon assertions from President Putin at the same time as well, isn't he?
Well, not unmerited, I'm sure. The thing is, Napoleon's seen as a bad guy in the UK, but in France he's seen as a good guy.
It's a good thing.
It's important to remember that being compared to Napoleon in France is not an insult. It's actually rather the opposite.
Yeah.
So important to remember that. But actually, I just have one question, I think, for Rick, I think, which is just like, given the public opinion he talked about, you know, this anti-Russia, anti-Putin public opinion, is there any chance that members of Congress will come through and, you know, basically rein in Trump on this issue of Russia and Ukraine and actually the transatlantic alliance? I mean, it seems to me to be fundamentally important, given the views of the Republican Party traditionally and given the public opinion that Rick talked about. Is there any chance that Congress will do anything about this?
Rick?
Well, and I think I think the real question is, it's a bit of a bank shot. As Donald Trump's polling ratings have gone down about 11 or 12 points in the first month, some of it is about this, but most of it is about Trump seeming to be a figure of chaos, of Trump causing, with his tariff battles he's engaging in, causing economic dislocation and economic anxiety. As his polling numbers go down, you will see a resurgence in the Senate in particular, where there is a meaningful caucus of folks who are on the side of Ukraine still, although they are being quiet now. They've given Trump his opening act as in his second term. It hasn't gone well for anyone on the Republican side thus far. They're getting chased out of town hall meetings by angry crowds. They know that Trump has problems, and they're, I think, going to give him an off-ramp at some point and say, hey, boss, let us take this from here. We love you. Let us take this from here. I don't know if it'll work. I don't know if it's going to be sufficient to get through the anti-Ukraine, pro-Putin caucus in the House, which is most of the House. But I do think you'll see, as his overall numbers decline, he will have less latitude to do this kind of, you know, stunt that he did last Friday. Believe me, the conversations among Republican senators right now are their mortification over Trump's behavior on this is absolutely spectacular, but their fear of Trump's power with the Republican base is keeping them quiet at this moment. So that's fading a little bit. It may fade more. In a strange way, the fate of Ukraine is linked to the fate of the American economy at the moment. Mm. The worse the American economy does because of Trump's bad behavior, the better the chances are of Trump taking his eye off of Ukraine and his desired Putin alliance and of other powers in the American foreign policy apparatus reasserting themselves.
That's very interesting. And I can tell you're a strategist, Rick, because you take us nicely with that tease into tariffs, the other big issue. And in any other week, this will be one of the dominant news stories that would take everything else out of the water. But during President Trump's first term, his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, was fielding questions about whether Donald Trump reads at all. And he claimed that Trump reads the Wall Street Journal cover to cover every single day. This is a paper which had previously championed some of his free market, limited government policies. If he was reading it this week, there is no sugarcoating its view on Trump putting 25% tariffs on goods from Canada, Mexico too, bumping up the duty on China too to 20%. The dumbest trade war in history was the opinion on its opinion page. And Mr. Trump claims in interviews tariffs, his favourite word, will usher in a new golden age for America. The paper said, though, it's aware it has attracted the president's anger by calling the Mexico and Canada levies the dumbest in history, and goes on to say it may have understated the point. Well, this is how Donald Trump began the week on Monday. Going back now, he said, it's too late for negotiators, for anybody, for the neighbours.
On the tariffs, is there any room left for Canada and Mexico to make a deal before midnight? And should we expect those Chinese tariffs, the extra 10%?
No room left for Mexico or for Canada. No, the tariffs, they're all set. They go into effect tomorrow.
So the tariffs kick in on Tuesday. Within 48 hours, significant exemptions were being made, including for car makers. President Trump ceremoniously signed new presidential orders, rolling back the previous orders, ostensibly because of fruitful conversations with Mexico and Canada, too.
And I spoke to the president of Mexico, wonderful woman, today, and we helped them out with a problem they were having to do with the tariffs, short-term tariffs. And we had a very good conversation. Also, we discussed drugs, and they've been working much harder lately. Do you notice that? On people coming in and drugs, and we've made tremendous progress on both.
Rick, is this part of Trump's art of the deal strong-arm tactic, or is he rocked by the markets here and two countries standing up and shooting back?
Two biographies of Donald Trump, and I can tell you Donald Trump does not read. Donald Trump is functionally illiterate. He gets told things, he can read a headline, but he is not a deep scholar of things. But he can read one number very clearly. And every time he's gone up to the brink with these tariffs, the markets have reacted very badly. They've given up in the last 10 days about 11 or 12% of their overall value. This is hitting Americans in their wallets. It's hitting them in their 401ks. It's hitting corporate America as their quarterly report and earnings come out. This is one of the few signals he will listen to. And everything else is noise. Everything else is just smokescreen. There is no art of the deal. There is no 18-dimensional quantum chess that Donald Trump is playing. He is desperately leaping like a frog on fire from one lily pad to the other, trying to find somewhere to land this thing. He does not understand tariffs, but he likes the sound of it. He likes the populist sort of nationalist ring to it. He doesn't understand the damage they will do. No economist in America wakes up in the morning and says, wow, let's cut off trade relationships and make everything more expensive for American consumers. Mm. Let's cause massive shortages across all these sectors. Let's dislocate hundreds of thousands of jobs every month until these tariffs fall apart. None of it makes sense, except to Donald Trump and the sort of populist bell ringers that are around him, who think that they're going to win over working class Americans or more working class Americans with this tariff message. And right now what it's going to do is blow a huge hole in working class Americans' prospects for employment.
Rick, good to have your voice on that. I want to return, we have 30 seconds, but I do want to return to Toma, where we started, to take us into next week. Toma, 30 seconds, Saudi Arabia, the summit. What are your expectations?
Honestly, I don't have high hopes for that one. Clearly, Trump's team is continuing to push the same rhetoric. They're continuing to try to force Ukraine into a peace deal that will inevitably lead to a disaster. So what I hope will happen is that Ukraine's team will just use it as smartly as possible to win more time for Ukraine and Europe, to rearm, to prepare for the world where the United States is no longer a reliable ally and where the United States is largely siding with Russia.
Toma, great to have you with us this evening. Toma Istomina, Deputy Chief Editor of Kyiv Independent. Huge thank you to my panel with a unique and essential take on another eventful week in global politics. Vivian Waltz, Paris correspondent for Time. Victor Mallet, senior editor at the FT. Rick Wilson, a Republican political strategist as well for the Bush campaign in the 80s, an author. And thank you all. We'll be back in 7 days for The World next week.